BBC News with Jane Brambley. The American Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, is to visit Afghanistan later today. His trip will be the first by a senior member of the U.S. administration since the current conflict began. He's expected to visit Bagram Air Base, north of Kabul, and speak to American troops there. Daniel Sanford reports from Kabul.
Donald Rumsfeld's been in charge of the American military campaign in Afghanistan. As part of a tour of Central Asian countries, he'll make a short stop at the Bagram Air Base, around 50 kilometers north of the capital Kabul. That is all he'll see of Afghanistan on the ground. He will speak to American troops at the former Soviet airport. He'll then fly close to the Tora Bora area on his way to Pakistan. The American Special Envoy to Afghanistan, James Dobbins, is also due to arrive to reopen the United States Embassy in Kabul as a liaison office. The embassy was closed in 1989 amid the chaos following the withdrawal of Soviet troops.
Mr. Rumsfeld's visit comes at a time of renewed fighting in eastern Afghanistan as anti-Taliban forces, backed by the US military, close in on Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda fighters. A new offensive is underway in the mountains of Tora Bora after the collapse of negotiations to persuade several hundred al-Qaeda fighters to surrender. From close to the front lines at Tora Bora, Damien Grammaticus reports.
High on the mountain slopes, a new assault has begun. From the very front of the battle came reports of new mortar and machine gun fire as United States and Afghan soldiers attempted to make fresh advances on the final pockets of al-Qaeda fighters. Haji Musa, a senior commander with the Eastern Shura forces working alongside the Americans, said surrender talks had broken down during the night. The al-Qaeda men had told him they are now determined to fight on. But they're being ground down by the attacks. At least two tanks were moved closer to the fighting.
Israeli helicopters have again attacked Palestinian security targets in the Gaza Strip, just hours after the American peace mission to the region ground to a halt. The most recent attacks struck at buildings in the Jabalia refugee camp, north of Gaza City. There are no reports of injuries. Shortly before the latest violence, Washington recalled its peace envoy, Antony Zinni. Mr. Zinni has spent 3 weeks trying and failing to find a breakthrough in talks between Israel and the Palestinians. In the first commercial shipment of American food to Cuba for nearly 40 years is due to arrive in the Caribbean island later today. A freighter carrying 24,000 tons of grain from New Orleans is being followed closely by another with chicken meat from Gulfport, Mississippi. Several more such consignments are due in the next few weeks in a $30 million operation to replace what was lost when Hurricane Michelle hit central Cuba last month. The food shipments are causing controversy in the United States. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. There's been a fire at a home for handicapped and elderly people in southern Italy, and officials say at least 18 people have been killed. The home is located in a mountainous area near Buccino, almost 130 kilometres east of Naples. David Willey reports from Rome.
Police say 10 men and 8 women, all seriously handicapped, died in a fire which broke out during the night, destroying a rehabilitation centre and home for the elderly in a remote area of southern Italy. The area was hit by a disastrous earthquake 21 years ago, and the disabled people, aged between 25 and 60, were housed in prefabricated huts, originally donated by the French government for earthquake relief. Police said the cause of the fire appeared to be a short circuit. The blaze ripped quickly through the three buildings, and by the time firemen arrived from the nearest town, the prefabricated structures had been completely destroyed. 10 people, including medical staff, survived the fire. Most are in hospital with burns.
The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, has given a strong warning to banks which resist his controversial legal reforms. President Chavez said banks failing to observe the country's laws could be nationalized and bankers imprisoned. He was responding to criticism of legislation aimed at helping the poor and aiding development. Mr. Chavez said his Venezuelan revolution was a peaceful one, but that it was armed. He said it should be defeated only over his dead body. Banks and businesses in Venezuela have protested at the legislation. A British Sunday newspaper has resumed its campaign of naming and shaming paedophiles following the resolution last week of a high-profile murder case. The newspaper, The News of the World, provoked uproar last year when it began its crusade following the murder of an 8-year-old girl. The man convicted last week for that crime was a known paedophile. BBC News.
BBC World Service. And now we present from our own correspondent.
Hello, this is Sandy Walsh. Today, a portrait of the University of Kabul, a symbol of Afghanistan's recent history. How some women refugees from the war now living in the camps of Pakistan have little hope of returning to their homeland. We take a commuter trip on the Congo River. Echoes of the Cold War, how new borders in Europe resemble the Iron Curtain. And the Arctic Russian city now off limits to foreign visitors. The man who is leading the new interim government in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, says his first priority is to bring peace and security to the country. Mr. Karzai says he's starting work immediately on restoring the country's infrastructure. Afghanistan's descent from comparatively peaceful obscurity into protracted warfare began more than two decades ago. In the intervening years, much of the country's infrastructure, including the well-known university in the capital, Kabul, was badly damaged. As Alan Johnston's been finding out, the university played a key role in the country's recent history.
An old Kabul University professor I know, a tall, thin man with a greying beard, loves to talk of the years when he was a student on the campus. These were among Afghanistan's last years of peace and the best days of the professor's life. The university was one of Asia's finest. The elite of Afghanistan passed through its doors. The campus was built mostly with American money, and British and French academics taught in faculty buildings that were linked by gardens and tree-lined avenues. The setting was perfect, and the students had first-class libraries, laboratories, everything. But the country beyond the university was one of the world's most backward. The fine young minds gathered on the campus were hungry for ideas that might bring rapid change. Some looked to Soviet-style communism for a solution. Others were drawn to China and Maoism, and still others believed that the answers lay in political Islam. My professor friend watched as his university was gradually gripped by powerful competing foreign ideas that would eventually destroy both it and Afghanistan. There were demonstrations and fights and eventually some deaths on campus. And after the April Revolution brought a communist regime to power in 1978, it persecuted its Islamist enemies at the university. The professor said goodbye to Western academic friends and Russians moved in. But the university's troubles really began after the Mujahideen guerrillas captured Kabul in the spring of 92. As factions that now make up the Northern Alliance fought between themselves, the campus became a battlefield. There was huge destruction as fighters held out in the different faculties and looted everything worth taking. An acquaintance of the professor who tried to stop the ransacking of the main library was beaten so badly that he died a few days later. Books were carted off for sale or burnt to keep the fighters warm through the winter. Laboratory equipment was smashed and sold for scrap. Landmines were strewn in the campus gardens and dead bodies stuffed down wells. There were surreal moments too. The old professor remembers watching a fighter ride a donkey out of the rector's office. When he was asked what he was doing, the fighter said that the donkey belonged to the enemy and that he just arrested it. The professor was witnessing the ruin of the place in which he'd spent his youth and all his working life. And at the same time, the fighting had spread to his nearby home. Militiamen set up a machine gun on the roof, and the professor remembers watching their legs shake with fear as they fired deafening bursts at the hill behind the university. He could take it no more and abandoned the house to the fighters. They looted everything, but not before he'd returned to make one mad effort to save some of his academic books, an effort to preserve something from a more sane past. He loaded the volumes onto a little cart, and as he ran, he heard the bullets whistle through the air above him. The university had barely begun to recover from the impact of the fighting when the Taliban took control of Kabul and the campus along with it 5 years ago. In line with their almost total ban on female education, women were barred from all faculties. The university's academic range was drastically narrowed. The professor remembers going to a seminar on war-related trauma at which the Taliban Minister of Higher Education dismissed the science of psychology as useless. He told the audience that all the answers lay in the Quran. The Taliban have gone now, and so have the landmines. But strolling through the gardens, you still see everywhere the signs of destruction from the time that the university was a front line. There's been no water or electricity on the campus for nearly 10 years. Aging professors like my friend sit in freezing offices. They haven't been paid their tiny wages for 5 months. There are no phones, no computers, and no worthwhile books. Worst of all, there are very few students. Afghanistan's devastated school system isn't producing enough young people fit to go on to university, and fewer still can afford to. The education faculty managed to produce just one teacher last year. The whole university is on its knees, haunted by memories of a happier past. But for a few weeks now, there's been talk of peace in Afghanistan. After all that's happened, it seems almost too much to hope for. But you can see in his eyes that my friend the professor can't help wondering if just maybe something of the old days will return. That if Afghanistan can just hold to the course of peace, maybe the brightest and the best young Afghans will be back, aspiring to great things in a better country.
Alan Johnston in Kabul. Neighbouring countries have absorbed the tens of thousands who have fled the war in Afghanistan. Among those who have sought refuge in Pakistan are many women who have lost their husbands, fathers and breadwinners. Branwyn Jeffries in the Pakistani city of Peshawar says some have turned to prostitution to support themselves and their families. And she says they now face little chance of returning home.
It's not easy finding a prostitute during Ramadan. During the holy month, they lie low as their customers stay away. And in Peshawar, even during the rest of the year, the oldest profession operates with discretion bordering on invisibility. But I've been told in the refugee camps around the city that some destitute women coming over the border from Afghanistan had turned to selling sex to support their children. It's not hard to see why. The war has left many women widowed and without other immediate family. Village women, who only know how to farm, find themselves alone in one of the huge refugee camps or in a city. In Peshawar, at sunset each day, crowds of women gathered on the pavements outside bakeries, begging for bread at the breaking of the Ramadan fast. Stories, I've heard all kinds of stories from these women, Adrian McGee said to me. Sitting in the garden of his offices, he explained his work for a charity. In an intensely conservative society, they carry out education work on AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. That means not just going into schools, but trying to reach those most at risk, the sex workers of Peshawar and the other frontier towns. Adrian and his team have become familiar with the public pickup points, bus stops, parks, and even hospital waiting rooms. In the last 2 years, he told me, they'd seen a steady and visible increase in the number of Afghan women working as prostitutes. It's a hidden problem, and I can't put numbers on it, but it's happening, he said. Some of these women have no other option. They've tried to get other work, but it's so difficult for women, some turn to prostitution. Adrian sent us with one of his team, an outreach worker recruited from a male dance troupe. They often worked alongside female prostitutes, and he could take us to a brothel. Slight, lithe, and incredibly camp, he draped one leg over the other in the front seat of the car. Shops were closing in the dusk. Formidable-looking men in turbans hurried home by cycle, rickshaw, or horse-drawn cart. Inside the car, the former dancer broke in a high voice into a famous Pashtun love song, Bibi Shirini, giving it the full song and dance routine, swaying and making eyes at our young Pakistani driver, who was by turns embarrassed and pleased. We turned into streets becoming progressively narrower and shabbier until he told us to stop. Hurried inside a large house, we waited sitting on a bed. A young prostitute combed out her hair, watching us in the mirror. Five or six girls, none older than their mid-twenties, were ushered in to meet us, lining up to look at the two European women sitting in the bedroom of a Peshawar brothel. Friendly, shy and curious, they were all Pakistani, but knew of Afghan women. A few minutes of shrugging and smiling followed the inevitable question, how could we meet them? They would ask. So late one evening, I found myself sitting on the floor beside two Afghan women, both refugees. The younger, just 22, had arrived a couple of months earlier from Afghanistan, from a village north of Kabul. She pulled nervously at her clothes, her head modestly covered with a white voile shawl, as she told me her husband and parents had been killed in the war. She'd not long been married, a village girl with no education. Now, so ashamed, she wouldn't tell me, a stranger, her name. Left alone to look after three young children, two brothers and a sister, she'd walked with them into Pakistan, to Peshawar. If I had education, there's no way I'd do this work. She spoke softly. I wish something would come out of the blue to take us away from this life. We're forced to do this, so are other women. For the children, I've destroyed my life. The price for her shame is thousands of rupees, a fortune compared to any other work. But as prostitutes lose their novelty value, many are compelled to move from town to town in search of new clients, trying to keep their price high. So many of the refugees you meet in Pakistan talk with real longing of going home to Afghanistan. But this time, I didn't need to ask. For this young woman and others like her, there is no way back. Once a respectable girl, now a prostitute, she won't be able to return to her village.
Branwyn Jeffries in Pakistan. There are hopes for full-scale peace talks in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire. The three-year-old conflict, which has involved Rwanda, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Angola and Namibia, has resulted in the deaths of more than 2 million people. More than half the country remains in rebel hands, and sporadic violence continues. Andrew Harding travelled to the strategically important jungle town of Kisangani to observe how life continues on the banks of the Congo River.
Rush hour starts early in Kisangani. By 6 in the morning, the first canoes slip away from the muddy banks of the Congo River. It's light already, a warm grey dawn spreading over the jungle. The journey across takes a good 15 minutes of hard paddling, a constant struggle against the rippling current. The canoes, like the river, are fantastically long, a good 20 metres, carved out of a single tree. Each one can take 2 years to hollow out, the finished product a mosaic of thousands of tiny axe marks. The commuters crowd round them, waiting their turn. Up to 30 can fit in a single canoe. As they file on board, each step is a quietly understated balancing act. Women carry baskets the size of washing machines on their heads, and a sleeping baby tied to each back. Men lug bicycles the length of the canoe, piling them up at the front with the rest of the luggage. Years ago, Kisangani must have been a rather beautiful town, a neat sprawl of whitewashed colonial and post-colonial architecture. Mansions on the riverfront, cranes busy at the docks, the jungle kept at bay. Today, there's something rather claustrophobic about the place, something stagnant, suffocating. The jungle presses in on the town, a besieging army of green leaves invading the derelict buildings and warehouses. At Kisangani's international airport, water drips from the high ceilings. A solitary official sleeps, sprawled across the check-in counter. My guide round the town is José. Actually, he's not really a guide, he's a minder in dark sunglasses, an official from the local security ministry, who's supposed to make sure that I don't see or film anything strategic. Kisangani is an important place, one of the few sizable towns in a jungle as big as Western Europe. At the moment, it's in rebel hands, but a ceasefire is in force, a group of United Nations military observers has arrived, and the Congo's long and complicated war is supposed to be winding down. José and I get off to a bad start. For him, strategic is a word rich in meaning, encompassing schools, hospitals, and almost every other building. All are off limits. It takes a morning of phone calls and an afternoon of beers to sort things out. But by the end, José is transformed. Suddenly, we can go anywhere, talk to anyone. He's on a mission. I have to plead with him not to arrest a man who accidentally interrupts us during an interview. And he starts embellishing things, keen to make sure every meeting we have is dramatic and newsworthy. I notice one of the canoe paddlers, Tonton, has a scar on his neck. That was 2 years ago, he says casually. A rocket hit my house. But that's not enough for José. And you know what, he declares, it still hurts him sometimes. Tonton looks doubtful. Suddenly an engine roars into life, a rare noise in Kisangani. For 3 years now, the town has been almost cut off from the outside world. The river, Congo's main artery, has been severed by the war. It meanders through too many front lines. The only way to get in is by air, and that's expensive. Few people can afford to import fuel. The engine is a 60-year-old German one, encased in the hull of a rusting barge. The diesel powering it has been flown in from Libya. The barge belongs to Lucas Francis, one of the few white men still living in Kisangani. Lucas is Greek and has lived here since 1968. On his fingers, he proudly counts off the various wars and rebellions he's survived, like an old film star remembering past marriages. 96, 97, the Three-Day War, the Six-Day War. There used to be more than 2,000 Greeks in Kisangani. I've never dealt in diamonds or gold, Lucas says, too risky. Instead, he used to trade in coffee and oil. Now, Lucas and his crew are waiting for the river to open up again, the 1,500-kilometer route downstream to the capital, Kinshasa. Who knows when that will happen, he says, in slow, awkward French. The soldiers have robbed me so many times here. I've lost more than $150,000. He shrugs and looks across the river to the jungle. Ah, he says in his thick accent, the pillage, the pillage.
Andrew Harding in the Congo. Czechoslovakia ceased to exist around a decade ago, but the split was peaceful and went largely unnoticed by the rest of the world. So much so that it's still a surprise to many to find that there are two independent countries, the Czech and Slovak republics. The most striking evidence of the split is the way in which the border between the two new states has grown so quickly, out of nothing. Chris Bowlby received a rude reminder of this in the middle of the night on the train between the two capitals, Bratislava and Prague.
I was lost somewhere in the happy dream world of a slumped railway passenger who's finally managed to drop off. Then an insistent rap on the compartment door turned my dreams momentarily into an old nightmare. I was back on one of the journeys I used to make across Iron Curtain Europe, when sleep in dimly lit carriages was constantly interrupted by officious people with harsh torches and harsher voices demanding visas or tickets or hard currency. It took a few moments for me to realise that this eerily familiar performance was happening here and now, in a corner of Europe where borders have not gone out of fashion. First the ticket inspector, then the Slovak and Czech customs officers, finally two sets of border guards. Passport, passport, they asked, then demanded, then shrieked at my utterly befuddled fellow passenger in the compartment, a young Austrian busker with large cowboy hat and several bags of musical instruments. His dog-eared identity card, with which he said he normally travelled all over Europe, was waved loftily away by the officials. Passport! Here border! Only passport! In the end, he was forced to delve deep into a large backpack and noisily retrieve the required passport from amidst a confusion of clanging percussion, sheet music, and discarded socks. He explained afterwards how he revelled in the belief that borders mattered less and less to Europeans. I live in Hungary, he added, just across from my family in Austria, but much cheaper. I go to and fro all the time, hardly noticing where one country stops and another begins. The border we'd just crossed had come as a particular shock, because he'd completely forgotten that Czechoslovakia was now two countries. What was most shocking to me was to feel the physical division of a border, stretched across a place where so recently there was nothing at all. When I made the crossing the other way, from the Czech Republic to Slovakia, I went by road. Heading south from the Czech city of Brno, I noticed first how huge retail parks had sprouted by the edge of the motorway, the kind of commercial development with global shops and brands that thrives in an increasingly borderless world. As if to apologise for its rude disruption of international trade, the new motorway border crossing is disguised a bit like a shopping centre, with strange mock archways over its customs halls and lots of neatly painted car parking spaces. And just like a supermarket, it's the kind of frustrating place where if you end up in the wrong queue, like one containing a vanload of Ukrainian migrant workers, you're in for a long wait. You can, of course, while away some of the time working out the exchange rate between the Czech and Slovak currencies and how much commission you'll have to pay. New borders always mean bonanza time for money changers, as well as manufacturers of pompous uniforms, barbed wire and rubber stamps. In the days of Czechoslovakia, this region used to be the most mixed, with much intermarriage between Czechs and Slovaks and languages used more or less interchangeably. Now the border emphasises difference. Czech friends told me how much less contact there's been between communities in recent years because of the bureaucratic hassle. And the Czech and Slovak languages are growing apart. Now each side only talks to itself. The separation may well grow. If the Czechs join the European Union ahead of Slovakia, this, as the EU's external frontier, will become a still more formidable barrier. Even the Morava River, which runs along the border, is taking on a newly menacing guise. Last summer, 18 Indian would-be immigrants to the Czech Republic were drowned in its waters. The Morava used to be praised by poets and musicians as a romantic symbol of the natural mingling of Czechs and Slovaks, from which the creation of the Czechoslovak state had flowed. How my travelling companion, the Austrian musician, would have liked to learn those old folk songs about the peaceful river. They could be a kind of campaign theme tune as he presses for a continent where he can busk his way from country to country without anyone bothering him for official papers. But on our journey he was left in subdued, unmusical mood as we trundled on into the territory of the now strictly independent Czech Republic, unable to get back to sleep, spending our time swapping anecdotes about ludicrous border bureaucracies we had known.
Chris Bowlby contemplating the border between the Czech and Slovak republics. Last month, the Russian authorities announced that the city of Norilsk, which started life as a Soviet prison camp, will once again be closed to foreigners. To be fair, the city is hardly featured on tourist schedules anyway, not least because it lies deep within the Arctic Circle. Kevin Connolly spent some time there when he was based in Moscow in the 1990s, and he says it's the sort of place that you don't forget.
Everyone has a city that becomes special to them. It doesn't have to be like a song that enters the soul either. It can just as easily be like a nagging thought that robs you of sleep on restless nights. For me, it is Norilsk, big enough in its days as a prison camp to feel like a city, grim enough as a city to feel like a prison. It is not so much in the middle of nowhere as on the edge of it, a forbidding monument to communism's refusal to count the huge human cost of tiny economic achievements. I see Norilsk in a wire service report about nickel prices, and I see it all. The cars with triple glazed windows, the ring road cut through 20-foot deep walls of frozen snow so that it looks like a giant bobsleigh run, the people who find the meat they store on their balconies in winter so deeply frozen they put it in the freezer to start defrosting it. It was in many ways the perfect vantage point from which to chronicle the collapse of the Soviet Union, one of the closed cities that opened itself up to the outside world as the old system disintegrated. Closing a city was a crude and inhuman but effective technique for keeping its secrets. Anywhere that housed a factory making missiles or tanks, a nuclear research facility or a sensitive military installation was simply declared off-limits to foreigners. Soviet citizens needed special written visas to visit. One or two such places were either left off official maps or deliberately placed in the wrong locations on them, a useful civil defense tactic if the Americans had been thinking of using motoring maps in the event of all-out thermonuclear war. Norilsk was a city that only communism could have built, a dreary collection of apartment blocks and metal foundries halfway across the freezing wilderness of the Arctic North. 23 hours of darkness in the middle of December, 23 hours of daylight in the middle of June, and winter temperatures that regularly fall below minus 50. Its first inhabitants were political prisoners sent to exploit the reserves of strategic minerals which Providence had inconveniently deposited below the frozen ground. Finding workers prepared to live through the freezing nine-month polar night, though, eventually forced the Soviet authorities to resort to the most capitalist of measures, bribery. Workers in the polar north were given better wages and longer holidays than anyone else. Food supplies, even when they were erratic elsewhere, were usually good. In this part of the old banana republic, at least, they were, just occasionally, actual bananas. But even in the 1990s, the people of cities like Norilsk remained prisoners, in a sense. As the Soviet economy opened up, prices soared and the ruble collapsed against the dollar. Their high wages became meaningless. A month's salary might still be two or three times the Russian average, but suddenly it wasn't enough to buy a pair of shoes. Finding the money to move back to the continent, as they refer to the rest of Russia, was suddenly out of the question. A woman we employed as a fixer cried when we met her at the airport to hand over the $50 a day, which was our going rate at the time. She wasn't crying because we were leaving. just because she was overwhelmed that we'd paid her almost the exact equivalent of her life savings for 3 days' work. In that world before the internet, the mobile phone and satellite television, the spiritual cost of the isolation, though, was probably greater, although harder to measure. I still got a recording somewhere of a group of children singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm, which I'd used to illustrate a piece about how hard times were getting for Soviet ideologists. The fact that the country's children were warbling away about the wealth of a private farmer would, after all, have infuriated Stalin. But the recording stands out because the children have got the wrong sound effects associated with the animals, so that the cows go quack quack and the sheep bark. It gives the song a faintly surreal quality. You should try it sometime. But of course, it's really a reflection of the fact that the children were being taught English by someone who'd never even met a native speaker of the language. The local authorities in Norilsk haven't really given a convincing explanation as to why they're closing the city again. And in this age of global communication, there won't in any case be the same sense of isolation that was there in the old days. And somehow, while it is a grim and depressing thought, I can't help feeling that Norilsk will be open again one day. For that, after all, is the real point of those places that stick in the heart or the mind. The certainty that you have unfinished business with them, and that one day you'll be back.
Kevin Connolly's Russian Memories, ending this edition of From Our Own Correspondent.